AI speaker cabinets as inconspicuous as possible. This model is designed for stadiums, not Broadway theaters, since why would a Broadway show need this much sonic energy in ranges so low that you can feel them? It's a monster, promises the brochure. As the band began to play, Nevin flicked the iPad on his lap, then flicked it again. The subwoofers started booming. A water bottle on the table began to shake. That's when Lynn walked in. He was carrying his lunch and wearing a red Where's Waldo t-shirt. Waldo peeked over the text, "You can't see me." He didn't know that after 6 years of hearing his Hamilton songs in his head, or on his headphones, or in a medium-sized theater downtown, he was about to hear them on an exactingly calibrated, extraordinarily powerful Broadway sound system for the very first time. Jason Bassett, who stage-managed Hamilton on Broadway and In the Heights before that, has noticed that Lynn has a distinctive way of reacting to such moments. What I've always loved about him is that he's as much of an observer of his remarkable life as everybody else. His excitement is genuine, so you can genuinely share it with him. The band paused just as Lynn arrived, so the theater was quiet as he took a seat at one of the tables in the audience. He said his hellos and unwrapped his burger, then Lack cued the band, and the room where it happens came roaring out of Nevin's sound system again. The rinky-dink banjo, the booming bass, the thumping drums. Lynn froze, burger halfway to his face. He gaped at the stage and shouted to no one in particular, "Oh, fuck everybody!" Chapter 22. A picture of the recording studio featuring learned comments by Questlove and a thrown shoe. If Questlove isn't the Pope of hip-hop, he's at least a high-ranking cardinal. He's the drummer of The Roots, the author of the argumentative memoir Mo Meta Blues, the leader of Jimmy Fallon's house band, and an all-around musical savant. A man of his stature ends up sitting through a lot of pitches from people who want to bring hip-hop to Broadway. These long ago took on a wearying familiarity. You know, aerosol spray cans up into Bronx, breakdancing in the first act, that sort of thing, he says. When people told him about Hamilton, he assumed it had to be another entry in this grim parade. Seeing it at the Public left him shocked. No corny Broadway overacting, no hip-hop cliches, no spray cans. It sucker punches everybody that's ever seen it, he says, himself included. And it left him asking the question that lingered long after the show moved uptown. Is this the most revolutionary thing to happen to Broadway, or the most revolutionary thing to happen to hip-hop? It's been a while since hip-hop has been able to show its brilliance, he says. Now it's sort of coasting. In the mid to late 80s, when hip-hop was a teenager, it was discovering itself, and we were discovering it too. But hip-hop is now 40 years old. I feel like Hamilton is hip-hop saying, see, we still got it. We still got some tricks up our sleeve. I would never have thought that this is how you would shock people. Only a brilliant nerd like Lynn would even think to take a Hamilton book on vacation. Lynn felt, when he wrote Hamilton, that it could legitimize hip-hop in musical theater. He didn't want to do a rap version of Hair, the show that introduced rock to Broadway. He aimed at having an impact like Rent, which, in his words, ended the conversation of whether rock music belonged on Broadway. If you look at half the scores on Broadway today, they use rock. It's just in the DNA now. And this was my injection of hip-hop into the DNA. Don't forget how recently this would have sounded like a provocation or a joke. As late as the summer of 2014, in the wake of the early closing of Holler If You Hear Me, a new musical featuring Tupac songs, two New York Times critics mused in a podcast about whether hip-hop would ever work on Broadway. Questlove agrees that Hamilton can demonstrate hip-hop's value, but he puts the show in the context of all of American culture, not merely Broadway. Just from the way the story is told, I feel like hip-hop is now a legitimate filter, though it's always been legitimate to me. It's as vital and important as dancing or poetry or singing, he says. Of all the improbable things about Hamilton, the fact that so many hip-hop luminaries share Questlove's affection for the show brings it closest to the realm of science fiction. The greatest and most famous MCs, Busta Rhymes, Q-Tip, Common, Queen Latifah, Talib Kweli, Missy Elliott, Hammer, Chance the Rapper, Jay-Z, and producers RZA, DJ Premier, Salaam Remy, Pharrell Williams, came to see it and stayed afterwards to tell the cast how much they loved it. After seeing Hamilton, it may be reasonable to put at Lin-Manuel in your top five MCs list, tweeted Peter Rosenberg, the influential radio DJ for Hot 97 in New York. The BET Hip Hop Awards invited Lin, Renee, and David to participate in a cipher trading freestyle rhymes alongside Questlove and Black Thought, the lead MC and co-founder of The Roots. David may be in the best position to appreciate how strange this embrace has been, since he's not just a fan of these giants, but a fellow hip-hop artist. They're all people that I've wanted to meet and interact with, he says. If you told me I would get to meet them from doing a musical, I would have said, that's ludicrous. Questlove came to see the show again and again at the Public, bringing different friends each time. No matter what their background was, they kept loving it. If I read this quote, it would look like hyperbole. But I lived during the Thriller era, and it was almost the same thing, he says. Rarely did I see something that could unite demographics that had nothing to do with each other. My English teacher loved Thriller. The rambunctious kids, who before November 30th, 1982, the release date of Michael Jackson's album, were calling me racial slurs in the playground, suddenly were saying, teach me how to do the moonwalk. He didn't just sing the show's praises, he got involved. With Black Thought, he agreed to executive produce the cast album for Atlantic Records. On a long Sunday, Questlove came to Avatar Studios in Midtown to hear Lin, Leslie, Oak, David, and Chris record their vocals. It was a day of discovery for those guys. Hearing the music every night through onstage monitors didn't prepare them for the full complexity of Lin's score and Lax orchestrations, which the band had recorded the week before. Yo, this band is cold, said David when he heard Nonstop for the first time. This sounds so cold, I need a jacket, said Oak when he heard Cabinet Battle Number 1. After performing together 8 times a week, they knew each other's rhythms so well that when they went into the booth to record My Shot, the Sons of Liberty sounded like an actual rap group. There's chemistry there, Questlove said, admiring the effect. He also admired the way Lack ran the studio, marveling at how certain he was of the sound he was after, how eloquently he could describe it, and how persistent he was in pushing until he got it. Wow, he makes me feel like a lazy schlub, he said. When it was Leslie's turn to record Wait For It, his castmates stood in the control booth listening with Lack, Tommy, Questlove, and Bill Sherman, one of the album's producers. They were so impressed that somebody took off a shoe and threw it at the window, a sign of admiring faux outrage. Lack told them it was time to record their harmony vocals. I don't want to sing shit right now, said Oak. If the hip-hop world has a favorite track in the show, it's probably Washington on Your Side. Lin was delighted when Busta Rhymes told him that he loved the old-school way that Burr, Jefferson, and Madison finished each other's sentences as they concocted a plan to destroy Hamilton. Talib Kweli told New York Magazine that when he heard the song, he immediately thought, I want to know who wrote these lyrics. Questlove called it a tug-of-war song, which he has missed hearing in hip-hop lately. Lack even put a Questlove homage in the song. The kick drum and bass swing way, way back behind the beat, a feel that Lack loved hearing on D'Angelo's album Voodoo, which Questlove helped to mastermind. Lin knew the song had the potential to be a blazing hip-hop track. When he heard David tearing through Lafayette's verses, he realized that Lin the writer didn't need to abide by Lin the rapper's speed limit. It inspired him to write the blistering resignation speech that Jefferson delivers near the end of this song. What's particularly impressive about the version on the Cast album is that David recorded it early on a Sunday, a time when the only actors awake in the whole city might have been in that studio. He was sipping tea and spitting fire from take one. From the beginning, Lynn wanted a Cast album that would hold up as a pop album in its own right. He, Lack, and the other producers pursued this goal with the same relentlessness as every other aspect of the show. Most Cast albums are recorded in 3 or 4 days. Lack insisted on 2 weeks to get every vocal and instrumental part exactly right. Most ensembles are recorded in groups by miking the room. Lack and his engineer, Derek Lee, recorded each performer separately. He brought in Tim Lathan to mix the album, that is, to balance, sharpen, and fine-tune the recorded tracks. Not many mixers have mixed Broadway records, but also gotten shout-outs from A Tribe Called Quest, as Tim has. The hashtag BoomBapMaster, Questlove called him on Instagram. The most noticeable departure from the Broadway norm may be that unlike many Cast albums where the sound balance might be 70% vocals and 30% music, Tim estimates this album is 55 vocal and 45 instrumental. It owes a lot to Questlove's input. As Lack and his team rushed to get the final mixes ready, he and Black Thought came to Atlantic Records to listen and give notes. Some of Questlove's ideas were subtle, technical, an array of suggestions that encouraged Lack, Bill, and Tim to take more chances. One of them was simple and was delivered with all the authority that a man of Questlove's eminence possesses. Turn the drums up. There's an old complaint around Broadway that pop stars don't adopt songs for musicals anymore, the way Frank Sinatra and Ella Fitzgerald did. The reception of the Hamilton album made this complaint seem quaint. When it dropped, it charted higher in its first week of release than any Broadway album since Lerner and Lowe's Camelot more than half a century earlier. Rolling Stone gave it 4.5 stars, declaring that it proves that a Cast soundtrack LP can work as a powerful, cohesive, exhilarating pop experience in the 21st century. Billboard gave the album a 5-star review. The first the editors had awarded since instituting the star system a few years earlier. More intriguing, Billboard declared it the best rap album of the year. And 2015 was a strong year for rap albums. It included, among others, Kendrick Lamar's To Pimp a Butterfly, another dazzling extension of what hip-hop can do. Framing the Hamilton record as a rap album, among other rap albums, increases the odds that this musical could have the most ridiculous-sounding impact of all. Beyond legitimizing hip-hop on Broadway and changing the way the public thinks about hip-hop, it might change hip-hop itself. This play is just a baby right now, says Questlove. Who knows what it'll do? Chapter 23. On the origin and persistence of our national shame. After closing night at the Public, the Hamilton Company took a few weeks off and then got back to work. Through the 6th-floor windows of New 42nd Street Studios, where they reconvened for rehearsals, they had a view that was captivating and bizarre, even by Times Square standards. They could look directly across 42nd Street to Madame Tussauds. Over there, crowds lined up to see lifelike wax replicas with no actual life. Over here, actors who looked nothing like their historical counterparts were bursting with it. Almost everybody in the company that summer was in their 20s or 30s, and a handful who were a little older could pass for 30-something. Do the grown-ups know what's happening here? The rapturous reviews at the Public contributed to the loose, upbeat vibe. The Cast and creative team had work to do, but they also knew that the show was very unlikely to fail. A rare and enviable position for theater artists or anybody else. In the larger of the 2 rehearsal rooms at New 42, the one with circles on the floor, which marked the location of the turntable and made the place look like a high school gym, Andy drilled the ensemble. He added 2 swings, Neil Haskell and Morgan Marcel, to the 3 from downtown, Andrew Chappelle, Stephanie Clements, and Voltaire Wade Green. They needed to be ready to jump in when a member of the ensemble missed the show because of illness or injury, which always happens in shows as demanding as this one. Alicia DeLoria likewise stayed ready to jump in as one of the Schuyler sisters or Mariah. Andy cleaned and sharpened everybody's work, spending part of one day trying to achieve a tighter elbow drop in Nonstop. He also chased a phantom. My whole career I've been wanting to make a sit down you're rockin' the boat, he says. The show-stopping number from Guys and Dolls knocked him out when he saw it on the 1992 Tony Award telecast. He thought he might finally have it within reach, thanks to the final chorus of The Room Where It Happens. It might sweep the audience away. It might create that kind of roof-shaking release. It killed me when I heard it. I loved it so much, he says of Lynn's song. In workshops and at the public, Andy never felt his choreography did it justice. He wanted to find sharper ways to physicalize the envy that gnaws at Burr, who seethes at being left out of that famous dinner. He attacked it again at New 42 and kept after it when they got on stage at the Rogers. You have to become a laser beam, not a spotlight, he told the ensemble one day. Think of ripping somebody's flesh off their body. When somebody asked him to demonstrate the arm extension he wanted, Andy seemed less like a dancer playing to the back row and more like a monster flexing its limbs, tight, chiseled, scary. Day by day, tweak by tweak, he kept coaxing the dancers into making Burr's song a demonstration of how disfiguring ambition can be, and how sexy. While Andy worked with the ensemble, Tommy rehearsed with the principals in a room next door. Actors would perform a scene or part of a song, then he would amble up to them, crack some jokes, toss off an observation or an idea, and walk back to his seat, having shaped the scene without appearing to have done so. The best part of directing, Tommy says, is code switching, relating to dozens of different artists in dozens of different ways, finding the specific approach that will unlock each person's most creative self. He's a fan of Phil Jackson's books. Open the bag up, Tommy said to Renee one afternoon. He meant, keep playing with different ways to perform one of Angelica's scenes with Alexander. This was his gospel throughout the development process. For if the most essential trait of the Hamilton team was relentless creativity, a close second was ruthless pragmatism. Lynn, Tommy, and their collaborators shared an eagerness to try things, to try everything, to find what worked best. New discoveries, new mistakes, was a daily goal that Tommy had announced for the company at their first rehearsal the previous November. It's a way of affirming the very American view that Benjamin Franklin offered in 1786. When somebody asked him how the new union was getting along, we are, I think, in the right road of improvement, for we are making experiments. Watching the show at the public had revealed to Lynn and the cabinet many more things to try. Some changes came quickly, as when Tommy worked with Oak to retool his depiction of James Madison, giving the author the Bill of Rights more stature, more strength. A testament to Oak's nimbleness, Tommy says, of how easily the shift happened. Other changes took weeks to click into place. Lynn and Tommy thought that 25 things in the script needed fixing. Most were so small that the average audience member probably wouldn't notice the change. But a few were substantial, none more so than One Last Ride. At the public, the song skipped from Washington asking Hamilton to draft his farewell address to the two men marching out to fight in the Whiskey Rebellion to Washington singing the lofty words of Hamilton's speech. The song had its delicious moments. Lynn standing at Chris Jackson's elbow always got a laugh when he screamed at the rebels, "Pay your fucking taxes." But it never did everything that Lynn and Tommy wanted it to do. You run out of time, Tommy explains. Chris made it work, and we did our best. The rewrite to One Last Ride illustrates what all those creative impulses, all those pragmatic experiments were trying to achieve. To ensure that every single element in the show, at every moment, was serving the story. The story was not a list of events on a historical timeline, in Tommy's view. It was the emotional journey that Hamilton and the other key characters needed to make. Partly at Oscar's urging, Lynn and Tommy decided to rework that event-heavy song for something simpler, more expressive. It needed to reveal how Hamilton was affected when his friend, mentor, and father figure retired from public life. That was an easy thing to say, a hard thing to do. One day, Tommy ducked out of dance rehearsal to check on Lynn, who had sequestered himself in a little side room at New 42, trying new approaches to the song, rejecting them, trying again. They kicked around some ways to musicalize Washington's desire to go home, but didn't get anywhere. As he was leaving, Tommy mentioned the vine and fig stuff. Lynn sat up in his chair. "I don't know what you're talking about." This was unusual. They almost always caught each other's references, finished each other's thoughts. Tommy explained that Washington's favorite verse from scripture dealt with finding peace in seclusion under each person's own vine and fig tree. "Where is this?" said Lynn. "What is this?" he started Googling. Tommy went back to rehearsal. A few minutes later, Lynn appeared. "I got it," he said. The new song would be called One Last Time. Out went the Whiskey Rebellion, in came Micah, chapter 4, verse 4, the scripture passage so dear to Washington. Just as the revised lyrics came from Lynn's collaboration with Tommy, the new music was shaped by his friendship with Chris. "I know his voice really well. I know the sweet spot," says Lynn. When he turned the Bible passage into a lyric, he built the phrase, "their own vine and fig tree," on the intervals that Chris sings best, which, if you think about it, is pretty much what Hamilton did for Washington when he drafted the farewell address. Lynn and Tommy liked the personal nature of the biblical verse. Washington wanted badly to return to Mount Vernon, to depart what he called the great theater of action. But those lines from scripture had a public meaning for him too. In 1790, he cited the verse in a letter to a Jewish community that had immigrated to Rhode Island to seek relief from persecution. He was stating the principle that all men and women should find a safe haven in America, no matter who they are or where they come from. The second meaning of the song took on unexpected weight in the summer of 2015. The night before the full company of Hamilton reassembled, a white supremacist violated the safest haven of all. He gunned down 9 worshipers at Emmanuel AME Church in Charleston, South Carolina, one of the oldest black churches in the South. "It stopped me cold," says Chris. "It was a brutal reminder of the gap that yawns between the hope he sings about in One Last Time and contemporary American reality." To me, it encapsulated the thought that the struggle continues. The idea is perfect. The execution is not. It's never been perfect. From the beginning of the show's development, Chris had been wrestling with the founders' failure to eradicate slavery when they formed the Union. They lied about it. They lied to themselves about it. "It's the great shame of our glorious country," he says. "It's still affecting me, my parents, our lives." He tried to rationalize Washington's slaveholding for the sake of stepping into the man's shoes. But after a lot of inward struggle, he had to give it up. "I won't reconcile that," he concluded. "But it doesn't keep me from getting to the heart of who he was and trying to portray the truth in that." In the last moments of the show, when Eliza sings that Hamilton would have done more to fight slavery if he'd had more time, Chris, as Washington, bows his head in shame. It's his way of having Washington accept responsibility for what he did and didn't do. Chris knows that plenty of people in America are uncomfortable with having a black president. He also knows the symbolic power of Hamilton having 3 of them. As the show rehearsed that summer, the aftermath of the Charleston shootings demonstrated how real symbolic power can be. Activists renewed their efforts to remove Confederate flags from state houses, stores, and everywhere else. From the day Alexander Hamilton arrived in what would become the United States, he fought against everything that flag would come to stand for. "If they break this Union, they will break my heart," he said on his deathbed. His fight isn't over, Chris thinks. It's living and breathing. When he looks around today, he sees a battle of ideas going on, one in which even a Broadway musical has a role to play, in every word, note, and gesture. This is our own form of protest. Chapter 24. Of Jonathan Groff, his royal character, his notable career, his dressing room decor, etc. The four grandparents of the show are Sweeney Todd, Jesus Christ Superstar, Evita, and Gypsy, says Tommy. It was a dinner break at the Richard Rogers Theater, where tech rehearsals were underway. The cast had seized the chance to get out of the building since their workday was scheduled to last until midnight. The place was as deserted as a Broadway theater can be when there are only 4 days left before the first audience arrives. Power tools whirred, laptops clicked. Gypsy and Sweeney are shows about monsters, he continues. They're both about somebody who has already been judged by history, but the shows still create mystery about why the monsters do what they do. Evita and Jesus Christ Superstar showed that music could lead the way, meaning that they had started as concept albums and they were virtually sung through, like Hamilton. They both took mythical figures and humanized them. What about Les Mis? That might be the grandparent that raised us. There's a lot of Javert and Valjean in there, he says. Les Miserables is fundamentally about somebody who says, you have to live by these rules, and somebody else who says, sometimes you have to break those rules. Burr's inability to understand how Hamilton lives is one of his great obstacles in Act One. At the end of Act Two, he absorbs Hamilton's energy and kills him. And Hamilton acts in a way that is much more Burr-like. Something on stage caught Tommy's eye. An actor who had just returned from dinner was performing a grandiose bow toward the mezzanine. He touched his heart, he looked rapt, he bowed again. It was a parody of communing with the space or some mystical actorly crap like that. Groff, you are back on Broadway, Tommy shouts to him. Literally, Groff replies. There are dozens of people excited about that, says Tommy. The joke is that 31-year-old Jonathan Groff is, by far, the show's biggest star. In 2007, he collected a Tony nomination and the hearts of pretty much everybody who saw him for his breakout role in the rock musical Spring Awakening. He led the cast of Hair at Shakespeare in the Park a year later and notched a few other off-Broadway credits. But for the most part, he spent his late 20s getting famous on film and TV. He played a recurring role on Glee. He supplied the voice of Kristoff in Frozen. He landed a lead TV role on the HBO drama Looking. The announcement that Groff would be returning to Broadway as Hamilton's King George III, the charming sociopath who threatens and taunts the Americans, constituted big news. Many more than dozens were excited about it. But once again, luck and good timing had to intervene. Groff was the last principal to join the company of Hamilton, and he almost didn't join at all. On opening night at the Public, the King had been played by Brian D'Arcy James. He stole the show, but he was already committed to another role that began in a few weeks. Lynn and Tommy thought of Groff as a potential replacement. They liked his comic sensibility, his boyish impudence, what Tommy calls his King Groffery quality, a reference to the sadistic teenage tyrant of Game of Thrones. But King George III is a strange role to offer a rising young star. He sings only three variations on one song. They keep him on stage for just 9 minutes. Groff considered the offer mainly because he had gotten to know Lynn when they were both breaking out in their Broadway debuts. I thought, yeah, I'll go do something at the Public, mostly because I loved him. He's a nerd, he's a theater fan, he's a genuinely good person. He listened to a demo recording of You'll Be Back, the King's first song, and signed up for the show. And then I saw it, he says, and it was like, and here words fail him. I was weeping, and I did not expect to be weeping. It was a transformative experience. I felt like I'd really won the lottery. On the day before Groff's first performance at the Public, the cast held a coronation ceremony on stage. It was Brian's idea, a generous gesture from one well-liked actor to another, both silly and heartfelt. A garter was involved. That likability, Tommy says, is the key to both actors' ability to bring the role to life. How much more interesting is it to have a king who's going to do the most horrible things and is the other, and yet we love him? When Groff was in Spring Awakening, he won Broadway.com's Audience Choice Award. Three of them, actually. Groff was happy to steal some of Brian's choices. The king's extreme stillness on stage. A little shoulder wag he does toward the end of You'll Be Back. But he also started to play with what the song and its reprises could be. The great thing about the song is that it's bulletproof, he says. It's always hilarious. Literally anyone could walk on stage and get laughs. You can mess with it, and you still won't mess up the whole train. Everybody assumed that Groff's involvement in the show, The Reign of King George III, the Second, as they called him, would last 6 weeks. Then he would go back to looking, and the show would go uptown with somebody new, King George III, the Third. But a few weeks after his reign began, HBO unexpectedly canceled Looking. And it left Groff with a dilemma. Make a year-long commitment to play the king, a cameo essentially, in his words, or resume his climb through TV and film. What looked like a hard call from the outside really wasn't. It was a no-brainer, he says. A show like this comes along once in a generation. To be a small part of that is why I went into performing in the first place. It's such rare air that we're breathing. 8 times a week, Groff spends his 9 minutes on stage, funny, seductive, scary, haughty, perplexed. Because he treats the songs as a relationship with the audience, his performance naturally varies to match whatever energy the crowd feeds him. After the curtain call, you can find him offstage right and up a flight of stairs in the suite of dressing rooms that he shares with Lynn. During tech, he devised a plan to replace his door with a beaded curtain he found online. We're making it our little nest up there, he says. It's gonna get real personal. Chapter 25. On Killing Your Darlings, with reference to the Adams administration, the seductions of Ben Franklin, and songs on the cutting room floor. While the Hamilton Company prepared for Broadway, Lynn collected one last accolade from the show's downtown run, the Best Musical Prize from the New York Drama Critics Circle. At 54 Below, a cabaret venue in Midtown, John Kander presented the award, saying such nice things that Lynn cried on his way to the stage. He recovered sufficiently to tell the room full of critics politely but firmly that he would not be following the advice that several of them had volunteered in their reviews. I'm not going to cut 15 minutes. Hamilton had been and was destined to remain torrential. What you can feel is the overflowing generosity of somebody who has tapped into the well of his subject, and it just keeps giving more and more. And this does feel like Angels, says Oscar, whose work on the Tony Kushner 7-hour masterpiece, Angels in America, makes him an authority on volcanic literary hyperproduction. You just feel like, oh my God, there's no bottom to this. Lynn is unleashing the energy of crossing boundaries. He is saying, I can tell American history using popular song. I can mix Broadway and hip-hop. I can fly high and fly low. It feels like it's unlimited, and that liberatory feeling spills out into the audience. Even in its early incarnations, when the show was longer than it became, Hamilton never felt messy or scattershot. Lynn was profusely productive. He needed to be, to write a score with 4 dozen songs, more than double the usual number, but he was also efficient. As Jeffrey points out, Lynn wrote exactly one opening number. He wrote exactly one I Want song for the protagonist. That is not often said. This show does not have 20 or 30 songs in the trash heap. The few songs that did disappear help illustrate what Lynn and the cabinet were after and how different Hamilton could have been. Sometimes Lynn and Tommy rethought the tone of a particular moment. Lynn made an early demo recording of a boozy Hamilton, Lawrence, and Lafayette slinging filthy innuendo about Alexander's sexual conquests, but replaced it with a better-behaved A Winter's Ball. He made another early demo of Valley Forge, a spooky, dirge-like song about the carnage of the Revolutionary War, but decided to drop all but a few lines, which he folded into a more propulsive Stay Alive. One of them is Washington's grim declaration, "We're gonna fly a lot of flags half-mast." The public mourning for Washington once had a song of its own, but Lynn felt that they could do without it, since Chris ends Washington's farewell address by singing the lights out. Sometimes Lynn dropped a song because he narrowed his cast of characters. He started to write a country rock tune for Benjamin Franklin, in which the wily diplomat seduced rich French ladies to help the American cause. But Franklin was also seducing Lynn, who realized that Franklin would run away with any show in which he appeared. Lynn said adieu to Franklin, the French ladies, and the song. The most common reason for putting a song aside was to keep the audience focused on the story that Lynn and Tommy were trying to tell. In one cut song, Let It Go, Eliza tried to get Alexander to stop being so belligerent to his enemies, even as Burr campaigned for and won the Senate seat held by her father. A long, fruitless discussion among Lynn and his cabinet about how to speed up the song ended when Lack proposed that they skip Burr's campaign altogether, thereby saving precious minutes and eliminating a song that shared a title with the monster hit from Disney's Frozen. For a time, Burr sang a tearful reprise of Dear Theodosia to tell his daughter that her mother had died. The third cabinet battle, the fierce fight over slavery, didn't shed new light on the characters. The point, after all, is that none of the founding fathers did anything to stop it, so the song had to go. That's not a lot of misfires for 6 years of writing. It was a very direct ascent up the mountain, Jeffrey says. Lynn and his collaborators needed the creativity to generate thousands of ideas and the pragmatism to test them all, both of which are key Hamiltonian virtues. But the show only works because they possess a quality that their subject lacked, self-restraint. Again and again, they sacrifice little pleasures, a beautiful melody, a big laugh, in pursuit of an overarching goal. The Adams administration demonstrates Hamilton's lack of discipline and Lynn and Tommy's abundance of it. Hamilton despised Washington's successor, John Adams, and the contempt was mutual. Adams insulted Hamilton's parentage, calling him a bastard brat of a Scotch peddler, and belittled his morals by declaring that Hamilton's ambitions were due to a superabundance of secretions which he could not find whores enough to draw off. Once Washington retired to Mount Vernon, there was nobody around to quell Hamilton's destructive and self-destructive tendencies. In 1800, he unleashed a scathing 54-page pamphlet attacking Adams. Hamilton wreaked havoc on his own prospects and the Federalist Party that the two men led. Lynn's original version of the song included all the lyrics printed in the libretto, an explosion of pure fury, which must have been even more fun to deliver than it was to hear. But the song asked the audience to spend 2 minutes thinking about a character that they never get to meet. For the final version, Lynn cut all but his last two lines. Hamilton would have been wise to do the same. Chapter 26, in which the hero blows up his spot with the assistance of Howell Binkley's lights and other forms of ingenious stagecraft. When Lynn told the audience at the White House that Alexander Hamilton embodies the word's ability to make a difference, he was thinking of all the good things that language can do. Hamilton reminds us that the American Revolution was a writer's revolution, that the founders created the nation one paragraph at a time. But words can also wreak havoc. They also tear down. The heart of Act Two is a sequence of 4 songs that illustrate the destructive potential of language and the perplexing fact that Alexander Hamilton never used words more devastatingly than when he used them against himself. The sequence of songs, almost a play within a play, is shaped by Lynn's historical compression. On December 15, 1792, three congressmen confronted Hamilton with what they thought was evidence that he had misused Treasury funds, only to discover that they had stumbled upon a very different offense, that he'd had a three-year affair with Mariah Reynolds and paid her husband to keep it clandestinely going. Those charges stayed private until 1797, when a journalist who was friendly with Jefferson leveled charges of improper financial speculation against Hamilton and Reynolds' husband, feeling what he called a desire to destroy this slander completely. Hamilton published a shockingly detailed pamphlet describing the whole affair, trying to salvage his professional integrity, even at the expense of shaming his wife and children. In Lynn's compact version of the story, the three politicians who confront Hamilton in We Know are Jefferson, Madison, and Burr, and the decision to preempt their attack comes almost immediately after the meeting. Both acts of dramatic license make it easier for the audience to grasp the bewildering truth about America's first sex scandal. Hamilton made a conscious decision to write something that blew up his own life. That decision was dramatic, but it wasn't necessarily theatrical. A man scratches parchment with a quill. Somebody else flips through a pamphlet. Where's the visual interest in that? Tommy's challenge, as he puts it, was to find a vivid way to show how a couple of strokes of the pen can ricochet around the world and explode. He and his designers spent tech rehearsals at the Rogers, experimenting with new and more potent ways of depicting this crisis in Hamilton's life. It took cleverness to make that play within a play a theatrical climax of the show. But even more than that, it took extraordinary integration, many veteran artists working in harmony. In Hurricane, the second of the four songs, Lynn depicts Hamilton looking all the way back to his childhood, trying to find some way out of his mess. A prior collaboration gave Tommy and Andy an idea for how to stage this introspection. In a production of The Wiz, they had dramatized a tornado by having a little model house get blown to pieces and scattered around. Here, it became not just the things that make up a house, but the things he was made of, says Tommy. As Hamilton reflects on his past, figures from his life whirl around him, his mother, his friends, his enemies. Howell Binkley gave the song an eerie, dreamlike power. After 20 years as a professional lighting designer and more than 40 shows on Broadway, he called Hamilton the biggest challenge of my career in terms of storytelling. There are 4 dozen songs in the show, and many of them skip from one part of the story to another. It required immense resourcefulness to generate hundreds of different looks. Luckily, as Tommy has found in his 4 collaborations with Howell, he is incredibly fast. In Hurricane, Howell used a purplish light at the center stage and whirling instruments around the perimeter to make it seem as though Hamilton were in the eye of a swirling storm. Lynn says the sensation of standing in the middle of these unsettling effects is a distilled version of how he feels throughout the show. I'm staying in my lane and doing what I'm supposed to do while everyone is doing what they do at the height of their abilities. And if I move to the left or right, I'll get hit with a desk. When Hamilton has decided what to do and the 3rd song in the sequence begins, the action needs to detonate and it needs to be messy, according to Tommy. Bright white flares from 6 powerful lights, stronger instruments than Howell had downtown, fire the opening salvo. A nice sledgehammer effect in the words of his associate designer, Ryan O'Gara. Up to this point in the show, Nevin holds back on what his monster sound system can do, saving its extremes for when he really needs them. The Reynolds pamphlet is when he really needs them. The earth does move there. Hamilton's whole world has moved, he says. You don't just hear the murky, snarly opening chords of the song. You feel them. As the pamphlet circulates and Howell's lights flash and Nevin's speakers boom, the ensemble dancers erupt. They just go buck wild and play, says associate choreographer Stephanie Clemens. Some of them spin the pamphlet in front of their faces as if it's the steering wheel of an out-of-control car. King George joins in the evil glee, taunting Hamilton to his face. Jefferson flings pamphlets like he's dealing a pack of cards or tossing Benjamins in a P. Diddy video. He even hands a pamphlet to Lack in the orchestra pit. For a delirious few seconds, every kind of stage effect adds up to create the sense that with a few ill-advised strokes of his quill, Hamilton has put himself in a living nightmare. Then, in a heartbeat, the stage grows still. All that's left is the remains of that explosion, the rubble, says Nevin. Eliza steps into a pool of patterned moonlight to sing the last song in the sequence, Burn. Lynn's lyrics convey Eliza's bewilderment, the shock that she must have felt at her betrayal. Indeed, my angelic Betsy, I would not for the world do anything that would hazard your esteem, Hamilton had vowed during their courtship. 'Tis to me a jewel of inestimable price, and I think you may rely I shall never make you blush. The staging contributes to her feeling of shame. When Pippa stands in the wings, waiting to enter, she can hear the fury and chaos of the Reynolds pamphlet, the laughing and jeering on stage and in the audience. I like to imagine that's the feeling Eliza had when she read the pamphlet for the first time, she says. Paul Tazewell designed her gown to emphasize her innocence. The very open neckline suggests a vulnerability and allows the audience access to her emotionally, he says. Pippa, that's a good look for you, Tommy told her one day during tech. Moonlight, Tazewell gown, now all you need is fire. She got it. The sequence of songs ends with Eliza taking revenge for what her husband had done and what he had written. What retribution could be crueler or more fitting? She burned the letters he had written to her. She destroyed his words. Chapter 27. Giving an account of a hurricane with a notable appearance by President Obama and the remarkable rise of Anthony Ramos. The hurricane hit on a hot Monday in July. On the morning of Hamilton's first Broadway preview, the New York Times ran a front-page story about the show. This followed two other Times stories over the previous weekend and a photo spread of the cast in the new issue of Cosmopolitan, to say nothing of the dozens of stories in countless publications in the preceding few weeks. All afternoon, eager theatergoers flooded the sidewalk outside the theater to enter the Ham for Ham lottery, a chance to win a $10 seat in the front row for that night's performance. By the time the winning names were drawn, 697 people had entered. The crowd stretched most of the way to 8th Avenue and nearly shut down 46th Street. For all the commotion outside the Rogers, inside it felt like another day on the job. The contrast was weird. Considering the buzz from the star-studded downtown run and the fact that six of the 21 actors were a few hours away from making their Broadway debuts. I've never worked on a show where the stakes were so high and the temperature was so low, marveled Nevin Steinberg. That was largely because of the show's director. In rehearsal that afternoon, as Andy ran the cast through the curtain call, Tommy kept up a stream of banter and in-jokes so everyone stayed loose. Directing, he believes, isn't just giving notes to an actor after a scene. It's the tone you set at every moment. It's what you say in a 2-minute elevator ride. Before leaving his apartment that morning, he had thought about wearing a special outfit for Hamilton's first night on Broadway, but reverted to the usual untucked shirt and jeans. This is what they're used to, he says, meaning the cast and production team. He wants to keep them calm. Of course, it's also what he is used to. He needs to keep calm, too. A few days earlier, Jeffrey had offered a prediction of what would happen at the first preview. It wasn't verbal. It was a gesture. He put his arms together, raised them skyward, then flared them apart like a geyser going off. The prediction was also a goal. For just as directors steer actors and choreographers guide dancers, Broadway producers harness the public. They turn a show into an event, a phenomenon. At least they try to. Sander Jacobs, who joined Jeffrey as a general partner on Hamilton, as he had been on In the Heights, had a good vantage point to watch him do it. 2 decades earlier, he had been an investor in The Phantom of the Opera, a monumental hit that became the longest-running show of the time. As Hamilton barreled toward its first Broadway performance on July 13th, he thought, I have never seen a reception like this. At 7:30 on that hot Monday night, the lobby staff pulled open the doors at the Richard Rogers, and the hurricane swept in. Oh, look, cried a tall man in a suit. They've got the trinkets. They did indeed have the trinkets. The audience crowded the merchandise counters so thickly that the ushers had to scream at them to keep moving. The theater-goers who attend first previews tend to be boisterous. They're the people who have the date circled in blood on their calendars, Tommy told the cast. But the reaction that night even surprised him. The audience screamed when Lax Curly Hair appeared on the conductor's stand. They screamed again when the house lights dimmed. And they screamed some more when Leslie sauntered on stage to begin the opening number. When Lynn made his first entrance, the roar stopped the song for 18 seconds. The show felt like it lasted 6 hours that night. After the cuts during rehearsals, it was tighter, sharper, and a few minutes shorter than it had been at the Public. But the peaks and valleys of the audience's reaction still made it an ordeal for the cast. When it ended, they congregated on stage as if they just survived something. Jasmine was crying. Renee looked dazed. A career in noisy rap clubs hadn't prepared David for what he'd been through. I heard, and then nothing. My computer overloaded. He had spent the first 3 numbers wondering if he'd be able to finish the show. Pippa said that she was so scared during the opening song that I was drinking my own tears. The next day, and every other day throughout previews, Tommy held a company meeting in the empty theater. Rookies and veterans alike talked about the overwhelming energy that they had felt the night before. The most emotional response came from Anthony Ramos. Nobody's ever done that before, he said, gesturing toward the stage. We gotta rise up. We gotta fucking do it. He got a little choked up. I don't know about y'all, but it's been a long road to get here. A long road. At 24, Anthony is the youngest person in the cast. You might expect his more experienced castmates to scoff at what he said. In fact, they were moved. Groff would later call this the day Anthony had everyone in tears. Anthony hadn't spent as much time getting to Broadway as other people, but his road might have been the hardest. Anthony grew up in a housing project in Bushwick, a rough part of Brooklyn, where he played baseball and sang with his friends. In high school, he auditioned for the school talent show, realizing only after he'd been chosen to play the lead that he actually tried out for the school musical. He liked it enough to want to keep performing, but paying for training was out of the question. When he got into the American Musical and Dramatic Academy, Sarah Steinweiss, a staff member at the high school, an angel in my life, Anthony says, got him an interview with the Jerry Seinfeld Scholarship Program. I actually said, all I need is one shot. All I need is someone to believe in me, and I won't let you down. My grades are not a reflection of who I am. He got the scholarship. After AMDA, he pieced together gigs, went to open auditions, and struggled. When Tommy and Lynn called him back again and again, but decided not to cast him for a tour of In the Heights, he was crushed. 3 years later, he still didn't have an agent or manager. But a casting agent who saw him audition for a different show suggested that he try out for Hamilton. In the final callback, I was doing my shot and I wasn't acting, Anthony says. When I was singing, I'm not throwing away my shot. I could have exploded. I felt like a bomb inside me just went off that day. He learned that he had been cast as John Lawrence and Philip Hamilton, 2 fortunate sons who died tragically young in gunfights. Anthony can relate to that. When he first heard Lynn rap, "See, I never thought I'd live past 20," it reminded him of home. That's how a lot of people in my neighborhood think. A lot of them didn't live past 21. Tommy watched Anthony imbue both of his characters with an awareness of the randomness of who gets out and who doesn't. He's seen a lot of things that he wishes he hadn't seen. Anthony's mix of gentleness and persistence lends force to Blow Us All Away and Stay Alive, a pair of songs that routinely wreck the audience. Philip challenges one of his father's critics to a duel, even though he doesn't know how to fight and doesn't want to. "I fought for things in life," Anthony says. "I learned how to grind and hustle, but I was never a kid who was ready to fight all the time, you know what I'm saying?" His preparation for those scenes is pretty simple. He imagines how he would feel in that situation. He thinks of how scared he would be to look around and see no way out. It's easy to do. 4 days after Anthony spoke at the company meeting, the hurricane hit again, but stronger. On the afternoon of Saturday, July 18th, the block was barricaded at both ends. When the house lights dimmed, President Obama walked into the theater. Everybody cheered. Dozens of cameras flashed. At intermission, the fire curtain rolled down, dividing the audience from the stage. The company assembled on the set, and the president walked out to greet them. "It's really good," Obama said. "Sometimes it takes a while until people know something is good. Here, people know." After a big group photo, Obama said hello to Lynn's dad and kissed Lynn's mom on the cheek. He beamed when he looked up and saw Rocco Landsman, who had run the National Endowment for the Arts in Obama's first term. "You're not running out the clock," said Rocco. "No, man, I got things to do," the president replied. Then, loud enough for the whole company to hear, he said, "I've got to take my shot." On his way off stage, the president shook hands with Lynn and said, "I'm proud of you, man." In a gesture of self-restraint, Lynn had stuck to the performance calendar that they had announced before learning that President Obama was coming, the one that said Javier Munoz would play Hamilton that afternoon. Before disappearing into the wings, President Obama veered a half step out of his way so he could grab one more hand. "You're really gifted," he told Anthony Ramos. Chapter 28. A grieving chapter on losses beyond words. There are nearly 24,000 words in Hamilton. That is a lot of words. It is more than an audience hears in a performance of The Merchant of Venice, Richard II, or Taming of the Shrew. It is significantly more than in Macbeth. Alexander Hamilton speaks, sings, and raps more words in the course of a show than King Lear does. Hamlet dwarfs Hamilton. It dwarfs pretty much everything. But there's a revealing similarity between them. Shakespeare's longest play leaves its audience in the dark about some basic and seemingly crucial facts. It's not as if the bard forgot, in the course of all those words, to tell us whether Hamlet was crazy or only pretending. He wanted us to wonder. He forces us to work on a puzzle that has no definite answer. And this mysteriousness is one reason why we find the play irresistible. Hamilton is riddled with question marks. The first act begins with a question, and so does the second. The entire relationship between Hamilton and Burr is based on a mutual and explicit lack of comprehension. "I will never understand you," says Hamilton, and Burr wonders, what is it like in his shoes? Again and again, Lynn distinguishes characters by what they wish they knew. "What did I miss?" asks Jefferson in the song that introduces him. "Would that be enough?" asks Eliza in the song that defines her. "Why do you write like you're running out of time?" asks everybody in a song that marvels at Hamilton's drive and all but declares that there is no way to explain it. Hamilton, like Hamlet, gives an audience the chance to watch a bunch of conspicuously intelligent and well-spoken characters fill the stage with words, 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 only to discover, again and again, the limits to what they can comprehend. The idea that some things lie beyond even the most articulate expression is the subject of It's Quiet Uptown. Lynn wrote the song in part to solve a problem. A workshop in January 2014 had ended with burn. At a notes session in the public's conference room afterwards, everybody laughed at how he seemed to have written himself into a corner. How would an audience believe a reconciliation between Alexander and Eliza after hearing her sing, "I Hope You Burn"? Even more daunting than patching up their marriage, Lynn would need to dramatize their grief over their son Philip's death. Unlike the boyish camaraderie that he would recall for The Story of Tonight or the relentlessness that he depicted in Nonstop,